It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Glad you could be here as we learn about a program addressing the sexual side effects of cancer treatment on women's health. A recent review of the research suggests over 60% of women with cancer experience sexual dysfunction, but sexual health may be overlooked or deprioritized in fighting the disease. Call in with your questions, your thoughts, any point here, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Janelle Sobecki is Medical Director of the Women's Integrative Sexual Health Program and Assistant Professor of Gynecologic Oncology at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Sobecki, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Good morning. So why should women be concerned about their sexual health during and after cancer treatment?
Absolutely. Well, you know, for everyone, patients and, you know, the general population, both, sexual health is important to everyone, right? Sexual health may look different for every individual, but it's something that affects nearly everyone. And it's such an important part of a woman's quality of life. You know, we also know that cancer treatment, like you mentioned, can affect, you know, anywhere up to, you know, we think 75%, you know, in the work I do, even 100% of women who have had cancer and have gone through cancer treatment. So this is a really, really common side effect that is incredibly important to not only a woman's quality of life, but, you know, her relationship if she's in one, as well as her partner's quality of life and her partner's sexual health and life as well.
How do chemotherapy and radiation, you know, which are common cancer-fighting treatments, how might they affect sexual health?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we know for women, about two-thirds of cancers directly affect a woman's sexual organ. So these are cancers of the breast, cancers of the reproductive system, gynecologic cancers, you know, that includes cancers of the vulva, vagina, uterus, cervix, ovary. And so, you know, about two-thirds of women with cancer and their cancer treatment directly affects the sexual organ. You know, for the remainder of women with cancer, we also know that women with cancers that do not affect a sexual organ also have sexual health concerns. That can be women with, you know, colorectal or bladder cancers. I call those sexual organ adjacent. So treatments to those areas can have an impact to the sexual organs themselves. We also know women with other cancers like head and neck cancers, lung cancers, also experience sexual problems as a result of their treatment. Pretty much every cancer treatment can affect sexual health in one way or another. You know, surgery is a really obvious area where, you know, a woman has surgery to a sexual organ, that's obviously going to have side effects. Radiation therapy can certainly cause side effects, you know, to the surrounding skin, the structures. And chemotherapy, you know, I have patients who are in chemotherapy who describe a skin sensitivity, fatigue, you know, things that we don't directly think will impact sexual health, but absolutely do. Another area.
I'm going to just reintroduce you here for just a moment. Dr. Janelle Sobecki, talking about sexual health in women during and after cancer treatment. She's medical director of the Women's Integrative Sexual Health Program at UW Health. You can join in the conversation about sexual side effects of cancer, 800-642-1234. Dr. Sobecki, one other aspect here, you know, in addition to chemotherapy and radiation, are hormonal medications that are prescribed to cancer patients. What are those types of side effects in relation to sexual health?
Absolutely. So hormonal therapies typically cause a loss of estrogen. And what that loss of estrogen does for women is it can result in vaginal dryness, sometimes vaginal atrophy, which is where the tissues of the vagina change in a way that makes sexual function more painful, makes the intercourse more painful. You know, hormonal therapies can also cause other side effects, especially for women who are premenopausal. So that can include hot flashes, trouble with sleep, and all of these things together can create side effects that prohibit women from being able to enjoy a good sexual life.
How should patients, though, balance that cancer treatment, you know, versus the risk of sexual health problems down the line? I mean, that's a really tricky conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. And that, you know, that's a growing area that we are exploring to try to figure out how best to do that. You know, I think in cancer treatment and surgery, we talk so much with patients about risks, right? Risks of surgery, risks of treatment, risks of chemo. And, you know, I consider sexual health and risks to sexual health and sexual problems a part of that conversation. You know, we know cancer treatments are not side effect free. In fact, the opposite, they cause quite a few side effects. But sexual health is an important one that should be part of the discussion, along with all of the other side effects that we commonly speak with patients about.
We have gynecologic oncologist Janelle Sadecki raising awareness about sexual health in women cancer survivors. You can voice your questions, share your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Researchers, they find sexual side effects of cancer treatment are discussed much less frequently with female patients than with male patients, even when the treatment directly affects sex organs. Call in with questions, your experiences fighting cancer, and sexual issues you've encountered. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Dr. Janelle Sobecki, who is Medical Director of the Women's Integrative Sexual Health Program at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Sobecki, I want to just touch down on the oncology community here for a moment, because, you know, talking about sexual health has not been something that has been seems like a pressing concern. It's kind of been backburnered in the past. What is happening now among oncologists?
Yeah, I think, you know, the past, I would say 5 to 10 years has really shown growth in the awareness of this issue and awareness of sexual health as an important quality of life component to female cancer care. You know, there are very talented people across the country in various centers who are really advocating for this area, generating good research evidence for how best to care for this important issue. And I think, you know, it's gained a lot of traction. It certainly is not where we or our patients wish it was. But I think there are a lot of talented people really trying to improve this important area for women.
Let's bring on a call now. Kevin in Janesville. Hi, Kevin. What would you like to bring up?
Hi. What about the mental health aspects of a woman's sexual health post-cancer treatment, perhaps losing a breast to a mastectomy? Does this affect her mental image of who she is as a woman? So what are we doing about the mental health corner? Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin.
Yeah, thank you, Kevin, for bringing this up. You know, I think this area is incredibly important. You know, we know sexual health is not just our bodies, right? It's bio, it's psycho, it's social, you know, and those emotional and, you know, psychological or relational components to sexual health are incredibly important. It is also very common for us to see women who have undergone treatments have issues related to their body image and self-image as a, you know, a sexual person. We see this most commonly with women with breast cancer who may have, you know, removal of the breasts or surgery to the breasts. And if that bra, you know, if their breasts were a sexual organ, they now, you know, don't have one, or they have a breast that is reconstructed. And I hear from patients that, you know, the reconstructed breast looks good under a top, but doesn't function the same. And her partner, you know, may have issues related to needing to avoid that breast, you know, during sexual activity because it brings up, you know, negative feelings regarding cancer treatment. We work closely with some of our behavioral therapists at UW and, you know, across the state, so that, you know, issues that are pertaining to mental health and how that affects, you know, sexual health for, you know, women and their partners can be addressed alongside the other work that we do, you know, with some of the physical changes.
You also had surveyed women with colorectal cancer reporting lack of confidence or fear of incontinence during sex. What is your advice to women, cancer survivors, who feel unconfident in their body after treatment?
Yeah, I think, you know, the first is kind of a restructuring of, you know, how they feel and what they want their sexual life to look like. You know, when they're partnered, we recommend, you know, there are different activities that, you know, partners and patients can go through where they talk about areas that they do and don't want touched in a sexual encounter so that in the middle of a sexual encounter, there isn't, you know, an uncomfortable, you know, viewing or touching of an affected body part, which can be really helpful. You know, we also refer patients, you know, who need more talk therapy about that. And I think communication is key in recognizing that, you know, these women are not alone. You know, I do this work every day. And, you know, this is a community of people who we know this is so common and adjustments have to be made. But, it oftentimes it's deeper than that, right? The body and body image brings up a lot of negative feelings about cancer and fear of what the future may look like. And so, you know, like many things, it's complicated, but there's a lot of resources and a lot of ways that that can be overcome.
Your program refers some patients for pelvic floor physical therapy. What does that entail?
Yeah, absolutely. So we know that the pelvic floor, which is the, you know, sort of bowl of muscles in the pelvis, is really integral to many functions, but sexual function in particular. And so pelvic floor physical therapy can be incredibly helpful in helping women who have pain with intercourse, who have, you know, kind of in the tightness of that pelvic floor or trigger point pain of the pelvic floor. And it really works on helping that pelvic floor function normally, whether that's, you know, contracting better, relaxing better, and that can include external and internal, you know, manual manipulation. It's a very talented group of people and a really important piece of helping women with certain sexual problems.
How successful is it? How effective?
Yeah, so, you know, we have limited data, but the data that we have from patients in our own clinic who we have sent, you know, nearly all of them report that that intervention is helpful. You know, so we certainly have more to learn about how effective, but, you know, for our patients who have seen us in Wish Clinic and been referred, they do report that that was helpful.
Turning to sex therapy, in your survey of patients who participated in the Women's Integrative Sexual Health Program, few were referred to sex therapy. Why is that?
Yeah, referral to sex therapy and any of the other referrals that we do is really individualized based on, you know, the woman, if she has a partner, and the goals. And so, you know, any woman who is struggling with, you know, body image, mental health, a woman and a partner who are struggling about communication about sexual health or the changes that have happened after cancer, those are patients that we often refer. You know, so we take an integrative approach and, you know, refer patients to sex therapy when it's appropriate for the problem that they come to us with. And if we feel like that's a helpful component.
What about reproductive health and the potential after that cancer not being able to have a baby?
Yeah, absolutely. So that in particular is not my area of expertise, though many women where fertility is an issue. And so, you know, the most important part there is knowing a woman's goals, you know, discussing fertility sparing options if they are possible, depending on the type of cancer, and, you know, looping in our really talented partners at the Generations Fertility Center, you know, and taking a really multidisciplinary approach to, you know, maintaining fertility if it's possible, and having really thoughtful conversations with women about what those side effects might look like.
I wonder, Dr. Sebeki, like, this can be a sensitive subject for patients, and how do you recommend having the talk with your oncologist and not make it feel like you're downgrading the focus of the mission, which is to, you know, eradicate the cancer, and that would be the pure focus. How do you make this type of talk, you know, elevated and not make it feel like it's not important to what our mission is here, which is to cure this cancer?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, side effects are an integral component of every step of cancer care. So that, you know, side effects are discussed, they're monitored. We, you know, support women with therapies for side effects, and sexual side effects shouldn't be any different. You know, we know from, you know, providers and patients, it's uncomfortable on both sides. I think my best advice, and hopefully this program has helped, is that these issues are so common. Nearly every woman with a cancer has had some impact to their sexual life. And so arming yourself with that confidence to say this is really important and it's happening to nearly everybody. You know, the other really important piece of knowledge is that nearly every cancer organization recognizes sexual health as an important component of cancer care. So there is a lot out there about this issue, but there's a disconnect in the office sometimes. And with anything else, I think timing is everything, right? So if you're someone who wants to discuss this, you know, use the opportunity at the beginning of the visit to say, you know, whether that's an intake form or when you're getting your vitals checked, you know, say, I have some concerns related to my sexual health that I'd really like to talk about today. That sets the visit up for time to address that well, you know, rather than, you know, kind of everything's wrapping up and we call it the doorknob question, you know, we're ready to go and, oh, wait a second, I have this question. You know, and that's hard, right? That's hard for patients getting to their next thing. It's hard for the, you know, physician or medical provider. So I think timing and recognition that, you know, this side effect is just as important as surgical side effects and chemo side effects and radiation side effects, which we talk about and treat every day in cancer care. So there's no reason we can't do the same for sexual health.
Dr. Janelle Sobecki, Medical Director of the Women's Integrative Sexual Health Program, with us, an Assistant Professor of Gynecologic Oncology at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Still time to talk about sexual side effects and cancer, 800-642-1234. Dr. Sobecki, what sexual side effects of cancer are permanent for women?
I'd like to think none in the work that I do, but we know that unfortunately is not the case. You know, I think one of the biggest things we see is women who have either had their ovaries taken out or have had medications that cause a loss of estrogen, you know, that does permanently change the tissues of the vagina. And so we know those tissues will never be what they were when estrogen was present. And that can cause, you know, vaginal dryness, which can cause pain with intercourse. And those changes oftentimes are permanent. You know, certainly surgery, removal of sexual organs or, you know, a change to the sexual organs from, you know, radiation treatment, those things are permanent changes. Not to say that we don't have interventions to improve things, but many cancer treatments do cause permanent changes to somebody's body and sexual organs.
What needs to be further studied and examined in the sexual health of cancer patients?
I'm going to say everything. There have been so many talented people working on this. I think that, you know, we've highlighted one area, which is communication, you know, which seems like it should be simpler, right? We have done work and research that shows that women want their cancer team to bring this up. So we hear that certainly a lot. And, you know, we hear from providers, it's hard to talk about. And I think medical teams want to help, right? That's inherent in medicine and cancer care. But I don't know that everybody feels equipped to ask, because if a patient brings up an issue, they may not be sure what to do next and how to help them best. And so I think communication and, you know, recognition of resources is really an incredibly important step, because nobody knows there's a problem if nobody's talking about it. And I think that's an area that could easily improve.
Dr. Sobecki, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Janelle Sobecki is medical director of the Women's Integrative Sexual Health Program and an assistant professor of gynecologic oncology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. We have a link to the survey published in the journal Supportive Care in Cancer. You can find that link at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about pizza.
According to Dairy Farmers of Wisconsin, mozzarella is the most popular cheese in the U.S., and Wisconsin producers make more of it than anyone else. As Jana Rose Schleiss tells us, a lot of that mozzarella ends up on pizza, making Wisconsin a leader in frozen pizza production as well.
In a manufacturing facility just off the interstate in Kaukauna, Wisconsin, more than 30 employees work in unison on a production line that churns out one of the state's growing exports, pizza.
So today we're doing our Brewpub Hardy Artisan. So it's a little bit of a thicker crust, which you can tell.
Matt Salvig is the advertising and promotions manager of Bernatello's Foods. He's showing me around their massive frozen pizza factory. Bernatello's produces different pizza brands, including Orv's, Roma, and Brewpub Latza Matza. Marketing manager Adriana Freilich has been with Bernatello's for years, spending her summer breaks as a teenager working on the production line. She explains just how fast that line moves.
So we can go from anywhere from 60 units a minute to 180 to 200.
Each unit is one pizza. That's...
Yep, a lot of pizzas.
A large digital tracker on the wall shows that 25,000 pizzas have been made so far today. The pizza making starts in the bakery, where dough is rolled out and pizza-sized circles are cut. Just like when you make Christmas cookies, the leftovers are collected and put back into the machine to roll out again. After the crusts are baked in massive ovens, they're placed on a rapidly moving production line, where sauce is dropped on top, followed by the cheese and other toppings. Wisconsin's frozen pizza industry is big and growing. Along with Bernatello's, national brands like Tombstone started in Wisconsin. There are also countless small shops. So what makes Wisconsin the frozen pizza capital? Pizza pairs great with another Wisconsin staple, beer, and many of the state's frozen pizza brands started in taverns. It might also have something to do with Wisconsin's long winters. The numbers support that claim. Bernatello's sells more frozen pizza from November to March. Back on the production line, Selvig and I get a glimpse of the ingredient that helps the frozen pizza industry thrive.
And here's where it all happens, right here, cheese.
20-pound blocks of mozzarella get cubed, shredded, and waterfall onto the pizza speeding down the line underneath. Wisconsin is practically synonymous with cheese. We make it, we eat it, we study it.
As a cheese manufacturer would send us shredded cheese, and then we bake it on a pizza and tell them how it performed.
Mark Johnson is a scientist with the University of Wisconsin Center for Dairy Research.
Did it melt? Did it stretch? What was the color of the blisters? How many blisters it formed? What was the chew characteristic? What was the flavor?
The research done by Johnson and his colleagues helps producers develop a cheese that fits the needs of the frozen pizza manufacturers. Johnson has seen the frozen pizza industry in Wisconsin expand.
I started here 40 years ago. A frozen pizza was like your last resort.
That's no longer the case. According to the American Frozen Food Institute, people in the U.S. ate 1.4 billion frozen pizzas last year, making it an over $6 billion industry. Johnson says there's a big reason frozen pizza businesses have thrived in the state.
We just have this culture in Wisconsin. We make cheese. We make the best cheese. You got to make the best pizzas, right?
Looking at the production line, Frelick remarks on how much has changed since she first spent her summers making frozen pizzas.
This is light years beyond where they were.
And Bernatello's has no intention of slowing down, helping secure Wisconsin's place as the frozen pizza capital.
Gianna Rose Schleiss brought us that story on pizza production in Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore ways banks help us save and what new features could help build a habit of saving. Recent YouGov survey data finds nearly half of Americans consider themselves financially secure, but other respondents don't feel this way at all. One in 10 say they don't have any savings to fall back on at all. Call in with questions about saving strategies and what you wonder about the role of banks, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kia McAllister-Young is director of America Saves, a national nonprofit in Washington, D.C., an initiative of the Consumer Federation of America. Kia, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me, Kate.
Well, happy America Saves Week.
Yeah, really excited about that.
And, you know, this is also a time when thousands of organizations and financial institutions are really participating to help people save money. What is the role of banks in this mission to save?
Yeah, so we have close to, last count, nearly 4,000 organizations participating in America Saves Week. Many of those are financial institutions, so both banks and credit unions, and they are focused on helping their customers and members become more financially confident. That's the theme of America Saves Week this year, and so they're each financial institution kind of has their own focus and really just there to support their customers and members and give them additional financial education. Some of them are running contests. So it's really fun to see how each financial institution and participating organization gets creative with America Saves Week, for sure.
What education should banks be providing their customers about personal finance?
Yeah, so it runs the gamut, right? We have some people who have low to moderate income that are customers and members of financial institutions, and then we have those who are wealthy. And banks and credit unions should have various solutions depending on who is their customer and member makeup. So anything from being able to learn some simple saving strategies if they have a lower income, to how to invest and, you know, some really great vehicles for that. And then they're also products. So providing mortgages, auto loans, all those different things, but then being able to educate them around how to become more informed and more empowered to choose the best products for them is really important.
You know, becoming informed and empowered also means, you know, understanding what fees banks are using. And I'm just wondering, I mean, we were seeing the Biden administration really trying to crack down on junk fees, as they call it,
yes,
you know, from banks with these unexpected hidden charges. What should we watch out for?
Yeah, so whenever we sign up for any kind of checking account or any savings account, we get a lot of disclosures and documents, and because we're in the moment, a lot of us overlook those. And to some extent, we really need to pay more attention to what we're signing on for, what those fees are. And even more than that, right now, there are a lot of financial institutions who are doing things to kind of level the playing field. So removing overdraft fees, and then making sure that your financial institution is helping you to translate all of those fees too. So it's one thing to just hand you a disclosure and tell you what's there. It's another if a person is going to make sure that you understand that information. So there's a lot of things for us to be looking for and to be able to decipher if your financial institution is in your corner. Look at what they're doing when it comes to overdraft fees right now, and translating those fees and disclosures for you and making sure that you are, again, informed and empowered. That will let you know if your bank or credit union really has your back.
Yes, I mean, and that's tricky, deciphering if the bank is really in your corner, because it's hard, I think, as a consumer to know if the fees at your bank for overdraft or debit or something else are too high or comparable or perhaps much better than elsewhere. How do you mm-hmm. figure that out?
Yeah, so it's no different than if you're shopping for interest rates on a mortgage or a home loan or shopping for insurance. You're going to have to check out some of their competitors to see what the pricing is, what their fees are, what their interest rates are, so that you can be able to, because the bank and the credit union most likely isn't going to tell you what their competitors are doing. So that's the place where we have to kind of do our own research and be able to see, especially right now with interest rates being as high as they are. One of the small benefits for us as consumers are high yield savings accounts. So being able to earn more on a pretty accessible savings account right now, does your bank or credit union offer that? And if not, can you find one that does, that's still easily accessible to you, and makes sense for you to participate in, so that you're earning more money on what you are saving right now?
And that is interesting, because I sometimes see an advertised, really competitive, good, you know, annual percentage yield on a savings account from a bank. But then I start to wonder, okay, so what are the account maintenance fees? If they're high, are you kind of canceling out that high annual percentage yield?
Absolutely. And that's where, again, going back to being informed and doing your research, nobody's going to have your back like you. And so when it comes to financial services, it's great to have people in your corner, but we also have to be empowered to go and find that information out for ourselves and make sure that we are making the best decision for ourselves. So again, going back to shopping and making sure that you're very clear on any fees or and the interest rates is super important when it comes to choosing your financial institution and what kind of accounts that you have.
Kia McAllister-Young is director of the national nonprofit America Saves, as we look at the role of banks in helping customers do a better job of building a cash reserve. Join in with your questions about how to save money, tips you have that have helped you build up a more sizable nest egg. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We dig into strategies on how to save more from each paycheck with Kia McAllister-Young here, heads up the America Saves initiative, helping people prioritize savings all year long and providing personal finance tips along the way. Call in with questions about saving up for different things, how you use banks, your financial outlook, considering unexpected expenses, 800-642-1234. Kia, the national average interest rate for a savings account right now is just slightly north of a quarter point, and the national average interest rate for a checking account is way lower than that. I mean, why is the interest rate of a savings account typically just a little bit more than a checking account, and why is it so low?
Yeah, I mean, I'm no expert, but my thought process behind that is that's not what makes banks the most money, right? By you saving your money, and so because it's not a
a product that is a source of income for banks, that the same way that like a loan product would be, is why you have a lower interest rate and why it's a great time to check out high yield savings accounts. There may be a better interest. Well, they do have better interest rates, but you know, when you look at the fees and the maintenance of that account, it may be more lucrative for you as an individual to check out those high yield savings accounts, especially right now with the interest rates.
What about online banks? You know, because that's another aspect of trying to find the best annual, you know, percentage yield. What should we look out for with online banks and also banks now being offered through credit cards?
Yeah. So you definitely want to check out what type of fees or minimums are required, if they're monthly fees, just, you know, again, looking at those disclosures, looking at other solutions that those online banks may offer you to make sure that this is a great banking opportunity for you all, like holistically and not just specifically for one account, to keep things pretty simple for you. Mm-hmm. And to make sure just opening the account itself is free or low cost.
What is your advice on linking your savings account to your checking account?
So, again, goes back to, you know, what's comfortable for you. To me, it's a really great way to avoid any overdraft fees, especially if you are banking with someone, with an organization that still does have overdraft fees. It's a great backup source for you. So there's no problem with linking the two of those. It makes it easy for you to be able to transfer funds in and out. The only time that you may want to consider not having those two linked is if you are really focused on saving and don't want your savings easily accessible. So maybe in your past, historically, if that savings money is there, you're going to use it and not necessarily for an emergency or whatever that savings goal is. And you know if it's there and easily accessible, you'll spend it. Then not having those accounts linked, or maybe having your savings account at a different financial institution, may be a barrier that kind of slows down that habit and allows you to change and transform that habit of spending your savings unless it's what you originally intended it for. But if you are someone who needs that overdraft protection or a backup, then definitely having your accounts linked is not a bad idea.
Yes, there are certainly two ways to see that. I mean, moving that money around really easily can certainly help in a jam, but also making it that accessible to be able to move it directly between those accounts, that comes with a risk of you have to be a little bit more disciplined about it.
Yes.
Let's take a call now. Marcus in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Good morning. So my great uncle Don, when he was alive, he used to tell me that you need to separate your wants from what your actual needs are. You should always cover your actual needs and occasionally cover something you want, maybe once a month, maybe twice a month. I don't know. And then he said, when it comes to your paycheck, spend less than what you make and save the rest and do that repeatedly.
Marcus, thank you. What do you make of great uncle Don's advice, Kia?
Yeah, I love Great Uncle Don's advice. And I mean, it seems so simple, but it's actually really hard to do. I know when I was younger and wasn't making a lot, the moment that I got paid, I wanted to go and do all the things that I hadn't been able to do while I was living paycheck to paycheck. And so even though that advice seems very like simple, it's actually a hard practice, especially if you make a low to moderate income. So kudos to Great Uncle Don for instilling that in you at a young age, and that it stuck with you, because that is the only path to building wealth and having a positive net worth.
Kia McAllister-Young with us, heads up the national nonprofit America Saves, as we talk about banks and savings accounts and getting tips along the way. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Kia, I want to turn now to the issue of the unbanked in America. I mean, there's recent analysis from Brookings Institute finding that the majority of Black and Latino or Hispanic neighborhoods have fewer options for financial services compared to majority of white neighborhoods. How can banks improve access to services?
Yeah, so financial institutions all have a corporate responsibility. And corporate responsibility includes a commitment to philanthropy, but also to upward economic mobility and ethical human rights. And with that, that means the same way that there are food deserts, there are definitely communities that have bank deserts where there aren't as many local banks that people can walk into. Or if it is a large Hispanic or Spanish-speaking population, there's no one in a bank that can speak their language. And so part of the corporate responsibility of financial institutions is to provide access and inclusion to their customers and members. And so, when you are looking to open up a checking and savings account, we talked about online banks, but looking to see where they are geographically located and that they're close to where you live so that you can access them or reach out to them. And if not, that they have like a 24/7 customer service support line is really important. And another way you can see if your financial institution really does have your back in making sure that it's accessible and inclusive and really great customer service and support.
We only have a few moments left, but Alan in Jackson found that their bank, they can go in and they can turn off overdrafts entirely. Have you heard of that being possible, Kia?
Yeah, absolutely. You can. So, do you mean that they can turn off the ability to have overdraft, or they don't have the fees at all?
Alan, can you explain a little bit here? We're tight on time, but what about turning off overdrafts?
Yeah. So, I'm with Navy Federal Credit Union, and I was able to go into my account online, and just there was an option to turn off overdraft. So they'll just reject the transaction, and then there won't be a fee.
Alan, Thank you so much. Kia, does that sound right?
Yeah, I actually also bank with Navy Federal. Yes, and that's what I was talking about. The credit unions or banks are making this easier for your customers to make that choice.
Kia, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Kia McAllister-Young is director of America Saves, and you can find a link to America Saves on our program page, wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.